Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg, here with engineer Mike Murphy and Anna Banana, who will be joining in a little bit later. Thank you for listening in. Before we get started with the news, a quick look at the weather. Looks like Indian summer. It should be sunny all week with temperatures back up in the 70s during the days and in the 40s and 50s at nights. Temperatures should climb gradually throughout the week, and Saturday is expected to be sunny and with warm weather as high as 78 degrees. Now here's Dennis Hart with a roundup of news stories from around Iowa from the past week.
The coronavirus made big news around Iowa, the United States, and the world last week. Word that both President Trump and First Lady Melania Trump had the virus and that the president was hospitalized reverberated, even as the death and infection toll from the virus kept climbing here in Iowa. The death toll from the virus exceeded 1,380 in Iowa by yesterday, and the number of confirmed cases also continued to rise in the state, reaching more than 92,000 by yesterday. Among those positive cases, 68 more people in the Iowa State University community. That brought the total number of students, faculty, and staff who had tested positive to 1,109. Last week's positivity rate was about 5%. In addition, about 400 individuals connected with ISU were said to be in quarantine last week because they might have been exposed to someone who has the coronavirus. Also last week, the University of Iowa reported that nearly 2,000 students had tested positive for the virus since school resumed. And the U of I also reported that it had received more than 450 complaints in recent weeks related to violations of the campus's coronavirus student safety protocols. Those complaints include reports of failures to isolate or quarantine after a positive test or close contact with a confirmed case. And Iowa City Police took numerous complaint calls last weekend about loud parties and coronavirus protocol violations at apartments, fraternities, and nearby houses. Meanwhile, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds announced this past Friday that bars could reopen in both Story and Johnson counties starting today, Monday. She had closed them during a surge in coronavirus cases. She also said the state would no longer recommend that people go into a 14-day quarantine after having close contact with a person infected with the coronavirus if both people were wearing masks during the encounter. Those new guidelines apply to places such as businesses and schools, and they differ from the recommendations made by the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. That agency says anyone who has close contact with someone who has tested positive for the virus should stay home for 14 days, regardless of whether those involved were wearing face masks. And Iowa officials moved to ease visitor restrictions at many nursing homes. The new rules allow for indoor visits at the homes. Nursing home residents in Iowa have accounted for more than 700 of the state's deaths from the virus. And while all this was going on, White House experts warned the state last week that its already serious coronavirus pandemic could get worse as soon as the weather gets colder. And the White House Coronavirus Task Force again urged Iowa to mandate the wearing of face masks in public, something Governor Reynolds has repeatedly refused to do. She says mask mandates cannot be enforced. Meanwhile, the Des Moines Public School District said students would start returning to in-person classes later this month. The reopening will start in preschools October 12th, in elementary schools October 19th, in middle schools on October 26th, and in high schools November 10th. The Des Moines schools will operate on a hybrid model, with students divided into two groups and attend in-person classes 2 days in 1 week and 3 days the next week. In northwest Iowa, a private Christian school told parents last week that it would not require students or adults to wear facial coverings. Orange City Christian School officials said facial coverings can do more harm than good for children. All this as a new Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll found that 54% of state residents think it is very or mostly safe for students to attend school in person this fall. 39% say it's very or mostly unsafe. There was also word last week that a new report showed that children in Iowa, especially children from non-white families, are more at risk of abuse, neglect, or other household challenges in light of the coronavirus pandemic. This according to a new statewide report that looked at adverse childhood experiences. There was also word last week that an Iowa nurse had been fired from her job after arguing with a patient's family who had said that the coronavirus was a hoax. State records indicate that Lisa Dockery had been fired from her job as a home health care nurse for Recover Health Services, an agency with offices around Iowa. She had been caring for a boy with severe disabilities. When the pandemic began, the boy's parents allegedly told Dockery they believed it was a hoax and refused to wear a mask around her or their son. And there was word last week that the Fairway grocery chain was still not accepting can or bottle redemptions because of worries that accepting potentially contaminated containers inside stores during the coronavirus pandemic poses risks to employees and customers. Meanwhile, Vice President Mike Pence came to Iowa this past Thursday, and he told a crowd at an event sponsored by the Family Leader Group that U.S. Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett would be confirmed to the court. He said President Trump had made good on his promises to appoint conservative justices to the court. In other political news, Iowa Republican U.S. Senator Joni Ernst and her Democratic Party challenger Teresa Greenfield faced off in their first televised debate in the state. They laid out their differing positions on a range of issues, from the current U.S. Supreme Court vacancy to Social Security, and they attacked each other's records in what the Des Moines Register called heated exchanges. At one point, as the candidates were talking over each other, the debate moderator broke in and asked, in his words, "Do either of you think you're acting like a U.S. senator? Is this the way Iowans expect their senator to act?" The most recent Register Iowa poll showed Greenfield leading Ernst by 3 percentage points. Iowa's other Republican U.S. Senator, Chuck Grassley, said last week that information about President Trump's tax returns should never have been released, and that whoever released it violated the law. The New York Times reported that the president has paid no federal income taxes in many years and little in income taxes in recent years. Also last week, an Iowa judge refused to block a new Republican-backed law that makes it harder for county officials to process absentee ballot applications and makes it more likely that incomplete requests will not be fulfilled. The judge rejected arguments by a Latino civil rights organization and a Democratic Party group that the law is an undue burden on the fundamental right to vote. At issue was a law passed this past summer that blocks county auditors from using their databases to fill in any missing information on voters' absentee applications. In another voting-related story, Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pate announced a new election cybersecurity initiative and invited security researchers to test the state's election system for vulnerabilities. In the U.S. House of Representatives last week, Iowa 4th District Republican Congressman Steve King voted against a nearly unanimous resolution supporting the peaceful transfer of power after the 2020 election. The House approved it 397-5. King said he voted against it because it targeted President Trump. The president has never clearly said whether he would leave office peacefully if his Democratic opponent Joe Biden wins the election. And last week, Terry Branstad, the former Iowa governor who is leaving his position as U.S. ambassador to China, defended President Trump's tough approach that has riled relations between the U.S. and China. Branstad said that approach has resulted in progress being made on trade, but he agreed that China generally has reacted to pressure by responding with pressure of its own. In Iowa City last week, word that University of Iowa President Bruce Harreld has told the State Board of Regents that he planned to retire. Harreld has been the U of I's president since 2015. He said he will stay on the job until the board can find his replacement. There was also word that the state of Iowa had ended its 2020 budget year with a surplus of $305 million. Republicans said it was because the state had shown fiscal responsibility over the years. Democrats said they don't think the surplus figure alone shows a full picture. In other news last week, there was word that 4 tornadoes had touched down in Iowa during that derecho windstorm that blew through the state in August. 3 of the 4 touched down in Marshall County. The 4th tornado touched down in Tama County. The biggest one in Marshall County hit northwest of Marshalltown and had winds of 100 miles an hour. That one damaged crops and trees and caused minor damage to some homes. Speeds of the other tornadoes could not be determined. In Des Moines last week, word that a Polk County judge would appoint a new developer to oversee completion of a 751-stall parking garage that is the first in a series of buildings planned for the downtown complex known as The Fifth. The landmark project is now in jeopardy since its original developers defaulted on a loan, triggering foreclosure. The $170 million project at Fifth and Walnut in Des Moines is scheduled to include the 11-story parking garage, a 40-story apartment and hotel tower, a theater, and a restaurant complex. Still in Des Moines, word last week that a man had been sentenced to 90 days in jail after he pleaded guilty to throwing a cat to the ground and swinging it by a leash. 49-year-old Jason Fortney pleaded guilty to animal abuse. The cat is recovering from its injuries and has been adopted by a new family. On the sports beat this past weekend, Iowa State University played Oklahoma at Jack Trice Stadium on Saturday, and as you likely know, the Cyclones defeated Oklahoma 37-30, the first time ISU had defeated the Sooners in Ames in 60 years. And one more note before I go, and it's about a well-known sign in Iowa. That sign belongs to Casey's General Store, which has had the same red and yellow barn-shaped emblem on its doors for more than 50 years. Well, this past Thursday, the Ankeny-based convenience store and gas station chain took the wraps off its new, modernized logo. This new one shows a plain, red silhouette of a barn, complete with a weather vane. And the words General Store are gone. Just the word Casey's is on the sign. The reason for the change? Research the company did that showed customers were not sure what a general store is. And soon, the new signs will replace the current ones at all of Casey's stores. And that is your summary of what happened this past week all around Iowa. I'm Dennis Hart, on the road today in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, but planning to return to the same virtual seat on Friday, when I'll have word on what makes news in Ames this week. Until then, stay safe and stay healthy as we all make our way through these uncertain times.
Hallelujah by Wa'ukikuna, which is a group of indigenous musicians who celebrate similarities of northern and southern hemisphere cultures in the Americas with shared beliefs about love and Mother Earth. And thanks to Mike Metz for sending this to us. KHOI's Local Talk brings Introducing the Candidate series, which brings you as many local and regional candidates running in the general election to be held in November 3rd as respond to our request for an interview. Ms. Lisa Heddens is running as candidate for the Story County Board of Supervisors, where she is an incumbent. Ms. Heddens is a Democrat and was formerly a member of the House of Representatives, representing District 46. She resigned her seat in June of 2019 after she was appointed to the Story County Board of Supervisors. Thank you for joining us, Ms. Heddens.
Thank you for the invitation, Ursula.
It's good to have you here. As we start talking, can you tell our listeners something about yourself that they might not find on the web or with a search engine?
In ninth grade, our high school history teacher had us learn all the presidents. And so I can still recite all the president's names from Washington to our current president.
Oh, wow. So who was the 14th.
Oh, I'd have to run. I'm going to have to run through.
You have to start at the beginning.
I have to start at the beginning and go through. Yeah, I've got kind of my rhythm to do it.
Well, I'd ask you to do it, but we have limited time, so I won't make you prove that. But that is impressive. That's. Can you also name all the states in the country?
I know all the states. I don't have the same type of kind of cadence that I have for the presidents to do that.
Okay. What's your favorite president?
Oh, gosh. There are several of them that supported initiatives that I like. Certainly was very impressed with President Obama. He's one who I certainly do like. But, if you also have to look at President Johnson, for example, who helped start the Head Start program that's done, wonders for children within our state and throughout the nation. So there's qualities in many presidents that I certainly like.
Uh-huh. Well, okay. Well, thank you. Would you tell us just a little bit about your background, what qualifies you for your office?
Certainly, certainly. So I certainly believe I have the qualifications to continue to serve as the Story County Supervisor. I have significant budgeting background, having served, as you stated, in the Iowa legislature, where I had served in either the ranking member or chairmanship position of the second largest budget for the state of Iowa, the Health and Human Services budget. I'm also a former executive director for a local nonprofit where I had the ability to work on putting together our budget and developing our long-term plan with our board of directors.
That was NAMI?
Yes, with NAMI Central Iowa, correct. Mm-hmm. And then with my current position, having been appointed a year ago to the Story County Board of Supervisors, having gone through the budgeting process, which, I could jump right in and understand what they were doing, how the funding works within the county, understand the programs, and kind of the various lingo, I guess you'd say that is used as well.
Now, you've been serving on the Story County Board of Supervisors as you've been working on this and as you've been talking with people in the county. What do you hear are the most frequent concerns in our county?
Sure. There are several concerns. Probably the largest one I've heard particularly this year has been consistent and reliable need for broadband connectivity. I think the pandemic highlighted that to a greater extent. More people were working from home, students that are taking classes online. If you're in an area of the county where there's either no or limited, or as I said, unreliable connectivity, you really are challenged to participate to that full extent. So that is certainly one particular area of great need in an area I'm already looking into state grants and federal grants to help address that throughout our county. Affordable housing. The supervisors put money towards a housing study to look at what are the needs and where and recommendations in the county for development of affordable housing. So that draft report is to be coming out in November with a final report in January. And hope we have some good suggestions on how to move forward to address that with not just the county, but with other local municipalities as well, because it's not just a county issue. It affects the other municipalities throughout our county. We need to continue to address our infrastructure needs, our roads and bridges. We do have a five-year plan to do either brand new, surfacing or just make some repairs. So certainly have identified those particular areas. All of it comes, again, with funding that's available, the age of the structure, the road or the structure, and, any other considerations that may elevate a road that you might have in year three to take to address, for example, but maybe there's been extreme weather or something else that has caused increased damage that we need to move it up. On our plan as well. And then lastly, I want to make sure that we promote economic development throughout our county, but we also need to balance that with our farmers, make sure they have access to soil preservation programs, water quality is a high priority as well. And then lastly, we do need to manage our tax dollars wisely. We don't have a whole lot of money to work with. We need to prioritize, and I'd like to be at the table to continue to work towards these initiatives, but to make sure that county services are of the highest quality and available to the residents of Story County.
Now, you've said that you have some concern about state and federal resources becoming less available in the next few years. How do you anticipate in making up for that or to move forward with infrastructure when you have more and more limited resources?
Sure. Yep. And we'll have to look at that. Right now, we are resources for our infrastructure. We're okay for at least another year or two, because we do have some carryover dollars that we can put in there. But kind of as a whole, we've come to the realization that state and local funding, or state and federal funding, excuse me, are dwindling, but mandates are increasing. So it is putting pressure on the county level to really focus on what are the priorities, what are the mandates that we have to provide.
What do you mean by mandates?
Well, for example, since we talked about mental health, since I worked in mental health, so the state has mandated particular services that the county will end up funding. So no additional funding came from the state, but they have an expectation that the county or region, we're an 11 county mental health and disability region, provide those services and that they're available to the residents for when they need them. So it's looking at how are we utilizing our tax dollars? Do we have the correct amount that we are levying for? Are there other grant programs where we can seek funding to fill in some of our priority areas that we'd like to work toward?
Lisa, I'm going to ask you a stupid question as a layperson, because I generally believe that if I'm wondering something, probably other people are too. How does the county actually get its money? How does tax money actually end up in the county coffers, so to speak?
So the majority of our funding does come from property taxes. I think it's around 65% or more, 65-70% is through property taxes.
And that's allocated by the state? The state?
No, that's through our county property taxes.
But how do the taxes actually get from the citizens to, I mean, we pay Iowa taxes. And do the county taxes come out of that?
We levy our for funding for the county services. So, yeah, you've got different pots of money that are going to go help fund state government, that are going to fund federal government, and then you're going to fund county government.
What does that mean?
So it would be like what's on your tax bill. So when you get your tax bill, your property tax bill, it may show that money was levied for mental health and disability services. You know, your property taxes is by valuation of your home and land, for example. When you pay your property taxes, that helps pay for county services. Mm-hmm. We bond for many for our roads and bridges. We bond for that so that we generate and have the money, because those are generally very large projects that we need to.
And when you say you bond, does the money come from the state or from the federal government?
No, it comes from local.
Oh, I see.
Right.
Okay. So when you talk about making up for limited resources from the federal government, are you possibly turning to local citizens to help make that up?
Well, I understand your question. Sorry, I wasn't quite understanding it before. When the legislature changed, for example, how counties could levy for funds for property taxes, they change the formula. So you've got your residential, you've got your agriculture, and you've got your business. When that was changed, there was what was called kind of a backfill of dollars that would be coming in from the state to help counties and municipalities for the state making those changes. There has been continued discussion that the state is not going to continue to fund the backfill. That is going to cause some significant cut potentially in services or the ability of what we're able to provide to the extent that we're able to provide. It would, you know, put things out to a longer term for implementation. So that is one area. Mental health and disabilities. We are limited as to what we can let for providing those services. You do have some state funds that addresses some of those services. Well, if you have less of those dollars, then it falls on the county to figure out how to make up. Or if they can't, it's narrowing down or reducing services. And I don't think in this particular time we want to be cutting mental health services at all or disability services. This is probably our most vulnerable population. So it's those challenges that we are facing or potentially facing as we move forward, as the future is.
And do you feel optimistic about solving those problems?
You know, I think what sets me apart is I understand the legislative process. I understand how you need to talk to your legislators. I know the information that you need to provide them so they understand the impact at the local level. So certainly that would be something I would continue to work on in talking with our local state legislators and, you know, our federal delegation as well, as the decisions they make at those levels, how it really impacts at the local level.
So what I'm hearing is that the working on the County Board of Supervisors really involves having a relationship with the legislature as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You have to understand the budget process. I mean, come January, that's the first thing you're going to go right into is to our budget hearings. And so that's going to consume a large amount of time. During the legislative process, we're always watching what the legislature is doing and how it may impact local governments. You know, we belong to the Iowa State Association of Counties and the National Association of Counties. So we stay on top of what potential legislation is going on at those two levels and how they might impact us locally so that I can immediately reach out to our local delegation and say, hey, I know that this bill is coming up. Let me give you the real story of how this is going to impact us.
Mm-hmm. And that kind of leads me to another question that I've wondered, and I think others have too. I guess what I want to ask is, why did you feel it was more important to serve on the County Board of Supervisors than at the Iowa House of Representatives?
Yeah, very good question. You know, I've always been interested in local government, and I have been asked several times over probably the last 5 or 6 years to consider running for county office. I had the great honor of serving at the state level. I am proud of the work that I did and some of the bills that I got passed, but I knew I was ready to step away from the state level and thought, oh gosh, if there was an opening, I would look and seek a position on the county supervisors.
Why do you see local as more important?
I don't want to say that it's more important than the state level. I think I looked at it as, you know, at the state level, you know, the legislation that you pass, and then at the local level, you see the impact. You've got a little bit more, when you're working on something, you see the results quicker. So I kind of look at it as like almost kind of like a project. At the state level is where I've started the project with some funding or some legislation on a program. And at the local level, I'm helping to complete that project through the implementation process mm-hmm. and can kind of see the whole thing through.
Well, Storick County is an agricultural county other than Ames. And in the recent years, there's been a little bit of a shift towards the topic of CAFOs, of the confinement lots. Can you talk a little bit about the shift that has happened?
Yeah, I mean, certainly we have seen that at the legislature. They came up with what's known as the master matrix in determining the development or expansion of a CAFO, confined animal feeding operation in counties. Story County has a team that when an entity states that they are seeking to establish a CAFO or expand one, that they go through and do the scoring of it. They review it, do all the scoring of it, and then that is provided up to the Story County Supervisors for a public hearing.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Lisa Heddens, who's candidate for Story County Board of Supervisors as a Democrat. Lisa, any last words?
Well, I just thank you all for listening this morning, and I ask for your vote on or before November 3rd. As you know, today is the first day of absentee ballots will be sent out, and would appreciate the opportunity to continue serving the residents of Story County.
Okay. Thank you, Lisa Heddens. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
And this is Local Talk here on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your host for the hour. Thank you for being with us. The coronavirus and the danger of community spread is once again front page news with the U.S. president becoming infected. Meanwhile, as Dennis Hart reported earlier in the hour, the number of positive cases in Iowa is approaching 100,000. And the Iowa Public Department of Public Health reported 10 more people have died from COVID-19, making Iowa's total number of deaths 1,381. And I noticed that the number does rise kind of on a daily basis. In Story County, 13 more positive cases were reported, bringing the Story County total to 3,551 with 17 deaths. In our continuing effort to keep channels of communication open about the experience that we're all having of the pandemic, we reached out to Mason Zastrow, who is a junior in political science, sociology, and philosophy at Iowa State University. He's also an off-campus senator to the Iowa State student government, and he brought heightened attention to the danger of community spread in Story County in August when he published an open letter to the administration of Iowa State University expressing his concern that, in his words, Iowa State and the Ames community are on the brink of disaster. This was a quote from a tweet that he made. The open letter went viral, bringing national attention as well as local attention. And Zastrow also brought a bill to the student body government proposing the return of students with all classes online, the return of students to their homes with all classes online. So welcome to Local Talk, Mason. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Okay, for starters, your experience with COVID has been up close and personal. As I understand, your housemate tested positive for COVID-19 after she was exposed in one of her classes, and you were in quarantine. Are you still in quarantine?
No, I've been out for a while. So okay. Luckily, I've been out and enjoying the free life.
Okay, the free life. You were not able to do an interview with us the first time we contacted you because you were not feeling well enough to do it. So tell us what happened to you.
Yeah, sure. So originally, I was in quarantine. And as soon as I found out that my roommate was positive, me and my third roommate both got tested. And both of our tests came back negative. And she immediately got shut in her room. And luckily, she has her own bathroom. So the only thing that we really had to deal with was her dishes. And I was the one who was mostly doing that. Unfortunately, about 10 days into the quarantine, I noticed that I started to have a little bit of a headache, and I just kind of shrugged it off, assuming that it was nothing. And then the next morning I woke up and I started to have a fever. I started to have some pain in my eyes. And then by the late afternoon, I had body aches and chills, and my fever was almost to 103. And so I went and got tested, but that test actually came back negative. But as far as I know, I believe that was a false negative because I had all the symptoms. And like I said, I'd been in quarantine. So I don't think that test was accurate.
So what exactly do you mean by a false negative test?
Yeah, so when you're designing a test for COVID, you have to decide how sensitive you want it to be. And no test can be perfect where you correctly identify every single person who has the virus while also not identifying anybody who doesn't. And the New England Journal of Medicine actually has a really great interactive where you can adjust the sensitivity. So a false negative is somebody who's actually positive with the virus, but where the test comes back negative. And even the FDA guidelines for adjusting or for handling workers who have COVID say that even a negative test isn't a perfect indication of whether or not a person actually has COVID. One estimate from an Oxford study back in April has a 95% confidence interval of about 82% to 94% on tests of the first day, where if you are actually positive, you'll get a positive test back. So that leaves somewhere between 16 and 5% of people who are going to be positive, get tested, and the test comes back negative.
And you think that's what happened to you, that you did have the virus and you tested negative?
I do, yes, because like I said, I hadn't been exposed to anybody else. And I had really, really just about all the symptoms. So seems like the most likeliest outcome.
So kind of I'm following what you're saying. Are you saying kind of simply put that you think that it's possible that a test could be inaccurate, could not show somebody having the virus because of the degree of sensitivity that is used in the test? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and that's absolutely true, yeah. Because the way that the PCR tests work is they take a sample of some sputum in your nasal cavity, and they amplify that view up and up and up so that they really allow any viruses to grow so that they can observe them. But if they get a sample of a part of your nose that doesn't have any sputum in it at the time, it's possible that you wouldn't get any of the virus at all. So it's a sample error that happens in just some number of cases, and that kind of thing can't really be avoided because no test is going to be perfect.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, you look like you're okay now, which I'm happy to see. Now, we were not offended when you canceled your interview with us. Because, as I understand, you also canceled with CNN, and
I did, yes.
And but you actually were on MSNBC right before you felt really sick. So you did get national attention for the situation here in Story County. How was the local response to your open letter to the Iowa State University?
Yeah, the local response was really strong. I got a lot of feedback from people who I had classes with freshman year and stuff like that, people who just kind of knew me tangentially, but could remember my email and stuff like that. I'll also say, and this gets, you mentioned earlier that I wrote a bill for student government, and I got a lot of feedback for that too, especially from the Greek community. That is something that I changed my mind on. In the original open letter, I did advocate for Iowa State to send students home. And shortly after, I did get a couple people emailed me a link where, just like the day before I published it, actually, Fauci had been speaking on that very issue. And he said that it would probably be a bad idea to send students home. So that is something that I changed my mind on. And of course, it makes sense, too, because if you take a lot of people from an area with a very high risk for COVID and you just send them back to, you know, I'm from Cedar Rapids personally. If you send it to Cedar Rapids, Minneapolis, Omaha, then you're not doing any good for the entire area.
So what you're saying is you're, in a sense, taking whatever is here and spreading it to the communities where people go home to, right?
Yeah, I think that there is an upside to sending all students home, but I don't think it's enough. What that would be is if Ames got to a point where our healthcare systems were being strained, we'd be reducing the maximum possible strain because there would be fewer people here. But since we never reached that point, and since it doesn't look at right now that we're going to reach that point, I don't think it would be worth it to send students home.
Well, you did bring this bill to the student body government, and I'm interested in the discussion. I know there was extensive discussion when you brought the bill, and this was in September, right?
Yes, that's true.
Uh-huh. So I'm interested in you sharing some of what ensued when this was debated in the student body government. What were the issues? Now, what you brought up one issue, which was you had originally said people should go home, and that was clearly discussed. What other issues came up as being really important considerations?
Yeah, so the three main kind of like action items for the university that we were asking for in the bill were, firstly, to move classes online, second, to send students home, and third, to share resources with the city if something got to a really bad point. And so the second one was removed entirely about sending students home. So the really debatable one was about whether or not classes should be moved online. And the discussion that we had there was really productive because I'm a student in philosophy, sociology, and political science. And so my classes are going to be very, very different from somebody who's aerospace engineering or a drawing and illustration major. And that's what student government does, is it takes all the voices from all the different majors, from all the different places that you could live, and it brings them together, and it kind of just gives a universal insight for all the different students at Iowa State.
So can you talk for a minute? Can you talk for a minute about the difference between a philosophy and political science student and an engineer, for instance?
Yeah, sure. So when you're talking about moving classes online, as an example, my classes are largely lecture based. And so I would have to read a text before class, show up to class, and then maybe I'll have a discussion about the text or about something kind of related. An engineering student might go into a class and use equipment that they only have access to in that specific class. Or a chemistry student's another good example, where they're doing titrations that you couldn't do without specific beakers and chemicals that you would have access to at home. And drawing spaces is another big one for illustration majors. They need studios, they need easels and oil paints that we just wouldn't be able to have outside of Iowa State. So what student government ended up doing is kind of shifting the language so that it's not, we need to move all classes online, period, to we need to move all classes online where an in-person component like a lab or a studio is absolutely necessary.
So, in other words, limiting the in-person classes to only classes where you'd actually need to be in a lab or have access to equipment, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That was the idea. And was that passed by the government?
Yeah, there was a pretty big agreement about that, that was a change that needed to be made. There were a few people who said, of course, we have the College of Veterinary Medicine here, too, and, you know, could you imagine trying to learn veterinary medicine over Zoom? The senator from VetMed actually did advocate for something a little more broad to moving classes online, in suggesting that even though her major specifically be very difficult to move online, we still need to make compromises even in these lab classes. But there was a large consensus around making the exception for labs and studios, stuff like that.
Okay, so I'm hearing that the issue of going home to your family or your community after being at Iowa State and possibly spreading the virus is an issue. The issue of students that actually need to be physically in a lab or a clinic or in a studio in order to do their work, that became an issue. What else became clearly an issue for students in this discussion?
Those really were the two big points of discussion. And right away, as soon as the bill was introduced, I made the amendment myself to remove the section about moving students home. So we didn't even have all too much discussion about that, because I'd been talking with senators outside of Senate, and there was a very large agreement that needed to be taken out. So those really were the two big sticking points in the bill. And then it did pass, I want to say 22-8 or something like that. So a pretty broad agreement from the student body.
What about the part of the bill that you mentioned of the university sharing resources with the community? I heard something to that effect.
Yeah, so that one was pretty much universally agreed with. When I was originally writing the open letter, I was really upset with how I don't want to use the word selfish, but maybe looking to themselves, the university was, because the university, of course, isn't insulated within the Ames community. And they brought all of these students here. The students weren't able to act responsibly, and the community ultimately could have paid for it had the outbreak gotten worse. So the purpose there was mostly just to say, we should share Thielen Health with the Ames community, and we should share the testing center in Hilton Coliseum with the community if it gets to a level where community members aren't able to get tests outside of those.
And did that pass as part of the bill as well?
Yep, that was all part of the bill. And as far as I know, Thielen and the Hilton testing center are both still students and staff only. But knowing that you can get tested at Test Iowa and McFarland Clinic if you're an Ames community member, I think it's all right, at least for now, that it continues as it is.
Mm-hmm. One more question. Something that's been controversial here in Ames has been the issue of attending sports events. Does the government of the student body take a position on that?
No. When I originally wrote the bill, I deliberately didn't include that because I was really trying to send a message to the Winterstein administration and kind of that decision process. And the way that the Big 12 works, those are decisions that don't just affect Iowa State, but, you know, it's Kansas State and West Virginia and all across the country. And so I was really trying to avoid student government kind of going with too broad of goals. And personally, I don't think that we should have fans in person at sporting events. But that's not the position of the entire student body. That was left out of the bill.
Okay. And did the ISU administration respond to the bill? Did you get a response after it was passed?
Not directly, no. President Winterstein hasn't said anything. He actually never emailed me back. None of the provosts did when I sent them the open letter. But that's all right. I think they have responded with their actions by changing the policy where if you're not social distancing off campus, that goes through the misconduct policy or misconduct process as well. After the bill was introduced, and there was a lot of feedback and people sending it to Winterstein in my open letter too, that's when the football game was moved to be completely with no people for the first game of the year. So I do think that there have been some effects, even if we haven't gotten a direct response from the administration.
Is that typical that a bill can be passed at the government student body and then it having, how do these bills usually have impact on the university?
Yeah, so of course student government can't directly make policy of the university. It'd be great if we could, but that's not where we're at right now. So what we do is basically we pass a resolution and that says the student body of Iowa State wants ... And it's just kind of of a list of the things that we believe would be better for Iowa State. And so the administration can choose to adopt those policies or they can choose to ignore them. But in the past, the Winterstein administration, at least when I've worked with them, have been they really do take the voices of students seriously because ultimately we're the ones who they're here to serve.
So these are recommendations, really.
Mm-hmm. Policy mm-hmm. recommendations or also just statements of what the student body thinks.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we're speaking with Mason Zastrow, who's a junior at Iowa State University. Mason, your final thoughts?
Wear a mask, social distance, stay healthy, everyone.
Okay, mask up. Thank you so much, Mason. We appreciate you spending time with us and sharing your thoughts and really helping us understand what the process is of looking at this from the point of view of the students. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And this is Local Talk here on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, and we were speaking with Mason Zastrow from Iowa State students, and Anna Banana, you're with us, and Mason, you're welcome to stay with us the rest of the show if you'd like. We have a few more minutes. Anna, I'm going to hand it over to you.
Yeah, thank you so much, and thank you for great interviews on Local Talk. So I'd like to share with you, to start our week, a poem by Carol Puck Rhodes that she reads to her Facebook followers on Sunday morning. So yesterday she talked about enjoying these tiny moments that reflect about being compassionate, kind, and retaining a sense of humor, which is important for these days. And this was her introduction to the poem. If They Come in the Night by Marge Piercy. Long ago in a night of danger and vigil, a friend said, "Why are you happy?" He explained, "We lay together on a cold, hard floor. What prison meant because he had done time, and I talked to the death of friends. Why are you happy then?" he asked, close to angry. I said, "I like my life. If I have to give it back, if they take it from me, let me not feel I wasted any. Let me not feel I forgot to love anyone. I meant to love that I forgot to give what I held in my hands. I forgot to do some little piece of the work that wanted to come through. Sun and moonshine, starshine, the muted light of the waters off the bay at night, the white light of the fog stealing in. The first spears of morning touching a face I love. We all lose everything. We lose ourselves. We are lost. Only what we manage to do lasts. What love sculpts from us, but what I count my rubies, my children, are those moments wide open when I know clearly who I am, who you are, what we do, a marigold, an oak leaf, a meteor, with all the senses hungry and filled at once like a pitcher with light. So as you know, Carol and Claire are also the co-founders of Love Letters to the World. And so I have a couple of love letters to the world to share as inspiration and encouragement for this day and week. The first one is by Ellen Cullen, who writes, "A bright copper halo, the sun over the candy floss cloth of the sky. We have no place to go save our imagination." And the next love letter is from Holly Kahn. "The silence of pre-dawn is a flat line, a blank manuscript until the blackboard fractures that silence to herald hope. High in the branches, a kite preens and prepares for flight. Letting go is the hardest part. Give me strength, give me wings to fly. The prayer rises on unseen currents. Out there, the world awaits." And finally, a love letter from Leslie Coates Jones. "First, I will bring you the space to dream. Then I will give you the wisdom to follow your dream. I will bring it to you on petals of beauty, rosebuds of fragrance, and the thorns of tenacity. Enfolded carefully in wrapping of love and tied with ribbons of self-knowledge and sealed with utter generosity in all things. You will then know the strength of abundant togetherness. This will I bring you." So if you'd like to share what is in your heart with us, I invite you to call or text Anna Banana at 515-809-0077, or you can email me at khoiradio@gmail.com and put heart to heart in the subject line. Or you can always visit www.hearttoheartmessages.com, noting that the two in the middle is a number, and check out the website. So thank you for listening to these individual heart-to-heart messages that connect us to a community of love, care, and support that is KHOI, the heart of Iowa, which is you and me. So until next time, I hope each moment of your day fills your heart with love, laughter, and peace.
Thank you, Anna. And speaking of KHOI, please help us support the operations of KHOI by also doing yourself a big favor by going to the KHOI Auction House. If you go to khoifm.org, our website, you'll see a big button there that you can click called the KHOI Auction House. There are really beautiful things in this auction house that have been donated, made, or services offered by many members of the KHOI family, also some for our artists that have moved on to bigger and better, but used to live in Ames, Iowa, and have allowed us to sell some of the work that they created while they were in Ames. There's also fantastic services like get your piano tuned for a really great price. And there is this incredible bird feeder that our own Patch Larbaugh made that is so beautiful and would make an absolutely spectacular a Christmas present for somebody who wants to really beautify their yard, not only with the birds that it attracts, but with the actual bird feeder itself. It actually has a reindeer horn on a horn. It's not a antler. Thank you. A reindeer antler on the roof of this beautiful, beautiful wood of the bird feeder. So go check that out. Or let me see. We have some beautiful pieces of jewelry. And there is the original Art Crumb coffee table art book, which is for sale in the auction house. There are just so many delightful things that we are very proud to offer to you. It's a great way to take care of some of the Christmas shopping anxiety early, and it's a great way to support community radio. All of the money from the auctions go to KHOI operations, and really, really appreciate your participation in the auction and the people that have given things to sell at the auction. Again, the place to the easiest way to find that is to go to khoyfm.org, which is our website, and click on the auction house button. And thank you for doing so. We're excited to be kind of sharing this these beautiful objects with you, and hope that you'll respond. And this has been Local Talk. I've been your host, Ursula Rudenberg, here with Anna Banana and Mike Murphy Engineering. The theme music, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. You also heard Alleluia by Wa'ukikuna. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. here at KHOI. Also, remember, you can hear a recording of the show later online at khoifm.org. And there also is a candidates page. You will see on the homepage of KHOI a link saying introducing the candidates. So you can hear the candidates' interviews again there separately from the show. And remember that you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Anna, what's the last sentence?
Yeah, thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting KHOI, and we'll see you again on the radio.